So I've been thinking about how to detect microlensing from the halo of galaxies for a long time. In fact, we were thinking about it before the Macho experiment, so we didn't know that we shouldn't be doing it in M31. And I would argue that actually studying microlensing in M31 is a good way to do it, and in particularly a different way to look at whether there are large masses in the galaxy, dark or not, distributed along the various sight lines through the galaxy, and whether there are enough to make up some of the missing mass. So in some ways it's very different. Mainly what we're looking for is amplification due to a mass passing in front of a star, and therefore for a point mass and a point source, a light curve that follows one of these family of Pozinski curves. This is from Pozinski's paper in 1986. And so I'm just, as he did, plotting log of the amplification of the amount of light. And this is scaled in terms of some characteristic time, the Einstein time scale. But basically, if you just have a point source and a point mass, it has to land on one of these curves somewhere. But what is very different is we're not looking through the halo of our galaxies, of our galaxy so much as through the halo of yet another galaxy, M31. And M31's got some interesting characteristics. It's nearly edge on, and it is confined enough on the galaxy so that you can study a huge stellar population all at the same time, but it's close enough so that you can still detect individual stars and use them as microlensing targets. What's not so obvious is that it also, because of the geometry, would give you these large optical depths, which would, in the case of a microlensing halo, give you a much larger signal than you might have expected, say, in the Macho type situation through our galaxy toward the Large Magellanic Cloud. So basically, if you were going to calculate the optical depth or the lensing probability for a given star, you would integrate over the cross section and the number of masses doing the lensing and integrating along the sight line. The lensing cross section depends on where you are along the sight line, so that if you're not close to the observer or close to the source, that's a good thing. And so basically there's a 1 power of the distance from the lens to the source in the cross section. So there are a number of factors that make the expected signal in M31 higher than it would be towards the Large Magellanic Cloud through our own halo. First of all, there are a lot of sources that would be expected to be sitting at large distances from the source stars, say on the back side of the galaxy, so that is pumping up the cross section a lot. The sight line is passing right through a large path length of high density region in the halo, and then, at least depending on who you believe in the literature these days, would expect that M31 has a large massive halo, although there's some disagreement about that recently. So depending on what this halo might look like, this lensing probability actually turns out to be, as these things go, a fairly large number. The lensing probabilities that are measured through our galaxy are on the order of a few times 10 to the minus 7. For the halo of M31, these are numbers that are a few times 10 to the minus 6, even approaching 10 to the minus 5. So it's much more likely for a star to be lensed if it's sitting behind M31's halo. So what I'd like to do is present the results from basically our prototype study to measure this. in the literature it's called the Columbia VAT survey, and a lot of it's the work of my student, and this is basically his PhD thesis that I'm presenting, so this is Robert Uglesich's heroic efforts. And collaborators also, he's done an awful lot of observing, and we had help from a number of people. But this is studying two fields on either side of the major axis of M31. Why on either side? Because of what I showed you before. If you're looking at a star on the back side of the disk, you're passing through a long path length of halo at high density. But if you're on the near side, you're sort of missing a lot of this activity. And so you get these very large differences in optical depths, high on the far side of the disk, low on the near side of the disk. And that's what we were setting up our survey to be sensitive to. Now, M31 is not like the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's not 50 kiloparsecs away. It's roughly 13 times that. And so when I talk about being able to detect the star, I don't really mean that we can individually photometer each one. They're all crowded together. So this is a patch of about 30 arc seconds of sky in M31. And you may think you see some individual stars there, and you do see a few. But on the large part, you just see surface brightness fluctuations that are made up of several or many stars. But what we do is basically perform image subtraction, which we developed in terms of, you know, how do you monitor variable stars when you can't resolve the variable stars? Well, you just subtract away all the non-variable part of the signal, and that's a lot more difficult than it sounds, but I'm not going to go into it right now. But basically, we just take a series of images, and using a convolution kernel, post facto turn all of the point sources into the same shape, and then we can go through and subtract off sort of an average image from the whole time sequence of images. And for instance, here, this is a nova that has just started to turn on. It's going to get a lot brighter than this. And you can see it very clearly in the subtracted images in the time sequence, but two successive raw images in the sequence, you just, the old way would be to blink two images and look for a change. But if you were to blink these images, you just can't see by eye where the signal is coming from. Unless, I mean, if you're very good, maybe you can. I can't see. It's not obvious to me that there is a much brighter star. Where is it? It's about right here, I think. Any of you see that? But that's a 20 sigma detection, and it's still a large factor below the surface brightness fluctuation. So this is just what we do. And this is a slightly larger field that shows lots of variable stars. So we can just go in and individually photometer all of these point sources. Some of them are positive because they got brighter. Some of them are negative because they got dimmer. We construct light curves by adding up lots of these aperture photometry measurements. And it's unfortunately the nature of studying M31 that you only get to look for roughly a third of the year. This is 1997, 1998, 1999. 1998 wasn't such a good year. But so we get these events that happen over the course of a season, and then we have to establish the baseline further downstream. And basically what we've done is find a lot of events that have chi-square of around unity per degree of freedom. For Pozhinsky fits, this is the shortest one. That's not typical. These other ones that are just sort of randomly chosen,
because they're next to the shortest one. Here's some more. This one's the longest one. And because our seasons were kind of short, we basically only required that we go through the peak. And this one is stretching that to the utmost. So that's the, one of the most embarrassing cases.
Is that basically on the pixel scale?
What's that?
Is this basically on the pixel scale?
I mean, this is a point source that's doing this. Is that what you're asking?
No, but you're not resolving.
Oh, well, I mean, it looks like any of these other signals in here. That's the light curve of one of these spots. Now, this is out of roughly 5,000 variables. We've pulled out these things that have chi-square per degree of freedom of roughly 1 for Pozhinsky fits. That alone doesn't mean that it's a microlensing event. We've culled out of this anything that is consistent with a Myra type variable, because unfortunately the peak of a Myra-like curve can look sort of like one of these Pozhinsky curves. 5,000 variable sources, a large fraction of those are Myras. If it's in danger of being a Myra, we just throw it out because that's probably what it is. What about all the other kind of variable stars in the universe? This is the best we've been able to do, which I think is actually fairly good at throwing out all the other variables. Let me explain all the different kind of symbols on this plot. This is a color magnitude diagram, absolute magnitude in I band versus V minus I color. And all right, all the little symbols first. I've taken the macho database of variable stars. These bigger symbols are in the bulge. These crosses are towards the LMC, and they measure a color, a magnitude, a variability amplitude, and a characteristic time scale. I can basically turn those into how big a bump do they make in the light curve and compare that to our detection limit. So these variables, if I'd plotted them all, would have actually landed on much more of this diagram. I've just plotted the ones that would make a bump above our detection limit. And so there are a lot of red supergiant variables, which are rather dangerous, because I know that, you know, the Myras, for instance, can make a microlensing-like signal. And these are perhaps largely irrelevant, because this is a very young, low metallicity population, and that's not really what we're looking at. These are in the bulge, so that is probably consistent. And then, not in this sample, but there's another paper, there's the infamous blue bumpers, which are along the tip, the top of the main sequence, which runs through about here. Now, the large symbols are our events, which happened to land in WIFPIC fields taken by HST, where there was an I-band image and an R or a V-band image. A lot of them were ours, where we were following up previous year's events. And so where do our source stars, which we found in these HST images, land on this color magnitude diagram? Well, two of them we actually caught in the act. These were actually being lensed at the time of the HST observation, so we can just subtract off the light from the light curve to get back down to the baseline. We measure a starlight, we subtract off the flux, and it ends here. And here are sort of the reasonable range of red branch color magnitude loci. And we would expect our typical microlens source to be a red supergiant star on the order of, say, 23rd magnitude, which puts you around in here somewhere. And that's where most of our sources end up being. This is below the region where we're in danger of seeing high amplitude variability in the star itself. So out of the 8 cases where we do this, 6 of them just end up being sort of run-of-the-mill red giant branch stars, which shouldn't be varying much. There's a red supergiant, that's bad, and one's over in blue bumper land. So that doesn't look very good. that is 8 of the 25 microlensing events in our most studied field. And they're distributed across the field something like this. Now, we weren't going to see many events in here. I mean, the edge of the CCD is actually about here. The surface brightness is too high in this part of the field for us to detect events much of the time. So our efficiency was way down here. This is the distribution of the events. These are the two that turn out to be in dangerous parts of the color magnitude diagram. There are 6 more of these that look fine. And then most of them we didn't test with the HST data. This is what we might predict. We have a number of different signals. We have galactic machos in front of M31 stars. That's if there's a microlensing halo in our galaxy. We have M31 machos in front of M31 stars. But one thing we know we should have is M31 stars in front of M31 stars. And so we've calculated this carefully. We have 2 different models. Basically, we turned Ted Baltz and Geza Juk on this problem independently, and they both came up with their own numeric codes for calculating event rates. And I'm pleased to say they came back only differing by the square root of 2. So when we unleash 2 theorists on calculating event rates, they come up with the same model except for one little error that we fixed. Now, the flattest part of this distribution's different contributions is due to the M31 halo. And that's sort of a telling sign. This curve is for a 20% macho contribution to the dark matter, which is what the macho project predicts. And what I'm basically saying that once we take our events, take into account that there's some fraction of them that ended up being variable stars, that's statistically consistent with 6 out of 8. We know there are full width half maximum time scales. What sort of halo do we need to do, to have, in order to get the same spatial distribution, the same time scale distribution, the same number of events? And this is basically what it boils down to in terms of how much of the dark matter supporting the rotation curve of M31 has to be due to microlensing objects. And the time scale gives us information about the mass of the microlensing object. So this is the main thing that we've been trying to do all this time, is come up with those 2 numbers. And so for the first time ever, I'm actually able to put up a view graph that gives us a halo macho fraction, basically 0.4 plus or minus 0.2, and a macho component mass that's sort of plus or minus almost order unity, but about 0.4 solar masses. These contours are computed with a given halo model. We actually have a number of different halo models that we can run through this. So there's going to be a systematic uncertainty that's going to end up on top of this. And if I were given this paper a week from now, I'd probably have that in there too. I don't think it's actually going to change the result all that much, but I like to stare at things for another week or two before we actually submit the paper. But for this particular halo model, I don't think we can get the numbers to change too much from that. So how that compares to the macho result, the full macho result comes in at about 0.2, give or take roughly order unity. The component mass is just a little bit higher than this. Both of these
numbers are consistent with the Macho result, and well, this is not very consistent with zero. Still, it's just a two sigma result, and I guess we never expected much better than that. This is the pilot project for something more extensive. We're in the final year of a much larger survey that's basically doing the same kind of thing. And it's a couple postdocs, and some other people at Columbia University that I mentioned or didn't before, a crowd of people at Captain, well, Penny Sackett's moving, and some of the same contributors from these other institutions. They've been putting in an awful lot of observing time on a much larger field with much higher density temporal sampling, so we're going to have better light curves. The main reason why is because we actually built our own large format CCD camera for the MDM Observatory telescopes. And this is basically on the telescope nearly all the time. And at an observatory like MDM, you can make deals with people. And so when it's clear and M31 is up, we're probably taking data. It's over a much wider field. Here are the MDM fields. We're also using the Kitt Peak 4-meter. We're also using the Isaac Newton telescope and Subaru and CFHT to some degree. But it's between 4 and 6 times the area. It's much larger sampling. We basically have about 10 times the sample as before. Here's our sample. It's most of the galaxy, most of the luminous stars. And to make, I imagine I'm running out of time about now, but we're going to be able to do more with this survey because if there is such a strong signal as 40% of the microlensing halo, then the fact that we're studying sight lines all over the face of the galaxy means that we ought to be able to tell you something about the shape of the microlensing halo. This is how the optical density contours change as you change the flattening parameter and the saturation core radius. There's large changes thereof. I'll just skip a couple view graphs which basically show the same sort of thing. We're almost through taking data. I'm hoping that in 2003 we'll publish some results, but the sort of sensitivity that we have with this larger survey, we ought to be able to measure the Macho fraction to something like 4% of the total dark matter halo, the component mass to something to within a tenth of a solar mass, the flattening parameter to within about 10%. We don't actually do too well on the core radius. It's a little bit surprising. I thought naively we'd do, but we can tell something close to singular from something very saturated in the middle of the distribution, a radius to within a third of its own value. And I think this will be very helpful because if this signal shows up again, and it looks like it might, then this will tell us something about the dispersive nature of whatever this population of objects is, how much has it flattened by being involved in the angular momentum of the formation of the disk. And this is a very interesting number in terms of, does this thing look like a Navarro-Franklin-White profile? I mean, if these were massive objects that were formed before the galaxy, whatever they were formed out of, one might expect them to be falling into the galaxy early on as ballistic cold dark matter. And can we still talk about a Navarro-Franklin-White type cusp in that case? So I'm hoping I'll have another view graph with some results next year sometime. We got a lot of people working on it, so thank you.
When you started, you worked out the different half-length for the control field and for the sampling field.
Yes.
And In the end, you didn't tell us anything about the control field.
Well, okay, we only found one event in the control field, which is consistent with what we expected, but okay, I sort of swept under the rug the fact that when you only have three people working on this project and a finite amount of telescope time, something has to give. And we basically devoted more of our time towards the field where we would expect a lot of events, because the spatial distribution in that field is still an interesting constraint. We have some statistically marginal statement about the asymmetry between one field and the other, but mainly we're able to say what we say on the basis of the distribution across the better studied field. Those eight events just happened to land in fields where WIFPIC was pointed and taking a VR and I measurement so we could get a color of the thing. And well, we will if we get the HST time. We're definitely proposing the next time around. We did some of our own snapshots. Actually, four of those eight were on the basis of our data, and the rest of them were pulled out of the archive. We're going to try to follow up with HST. We didn't get that the last time we proposed. The other thing that's very useful is that these red supergiant variables are going to be very bright in J, H, and K, and we do have time to go in with adaptive optics and see if there's some extremely bright infrared source there. If they have infrared colors consistent with supergiants, we'd better throw those out too, because that will end up in the bulge variable part of the color magnitude diagram. But we're gonna publish on the basis of the sample as it exists now. There'll be a follow-up paper when we've looked at all 20-some events in J, H, and K. Because unlike the Large Magellanic Cloud, it's not circumpolar. And so it's just too close to the sun, except between August and January.
Rains in Arizona in July. There's no observances in July.
that too.
That's the reason it's rain.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we also have INT time, but that buys us another month.
No, can I ask him also if you're going to flag your eyes to whether the newer data seems quantitatively consistent with the pilot project?
It just wouldn't be right.
I've been trying that for some time. Jason said,
where does the controversy stand up whether this can be white dwarfs or
not? Well, I think it's very difficult. If they're white dwarfs, then you have to have converted a large fraction of the baryons at some point into somewhat massive stars, and of that mass, about a third of it, half to a third of it, ended up in the white dwarfs. Where did all the other stuff go with heavy metal enrichment? You basically have to stuff a large fraction of the heavy metals into some other place in the universe, and you've written a paper about this. You have to blow it all the way out of the galaxy, otherwise.
Problem is, even out of the galaxy, it's in the
Lyman Alpha Taurus. Yeah. Tricky. Tricky, but it's pretty. 40% is really hard. 10% doesn't really buy anything. And there are light dwarfs that exist, but the data aren't really good enough to tell
certainly
whether they're the halo or something else.
That's right. But. I think even to get the Macho result, I'm not claiming a result that's any different than that. You still have to push on that Well, you still have to hide something in the intergalactic gas. Is that that's a fair statement, right?
Well, I mean, everything's hard. If it's a large fraction of the halo, then it doesn't agree with a whole bunch of things.
So how far, well, this number 40%, how far out does that go?
Mm-hmm.
How far out, what's kind of, what scale are we talking about? With LMC, it's 50 kiloparsecs, right? So
The impact parameter is out to 3.5 kiloparsecs. So the typical distance out in front of the is going to be 4 or 5 times that. Yeah. So that's 20 kiloparsecs.
One of the things that makes the macho event convincing is that they're achromatic. And I was wondering if you had any color.
Yeah, we do have color information. One thing I sort of skipped over. In the mega survey, we have very good color information. It's but I can't show that to you yet. Along with this color magnitude diagram, I can make another color magnitude diagram wherein I say, okay, what's the color? I'm going to look at the amplified color. I have to actually find, oh my goodness, where's the transparent? Well, this is what I'm trying to show you. Oh my goodness, I don't know where the transparency went. This is what I'm trying to show you. Overlapping this, the color that I can compute is just the color of the amplified light. And the magnitude that I compute, if I don't have an HST image, I have to go in and try to find this source in the ground-based images. And if the thing's any fainter than about 20-second magnitude, it's very difficult in this context.
But your light curves are only in light color.
No, the light curves are in I band, and in some cases we have very good sampling, and in those cases the shapes are very consistent, but in some cases, we don't have such good I-band sampling, so we're not using the achromaticity as a criterion. That's the unfortunate answer. There you go. The halo is down from a 20% M31 halo by roughly an order of magnitude. So there should be a couple such events in the sample. The halo events basically form a uniform sheet across the galaxy. It doesn't go then the number of events as the number of sources, because you actually have a background due to all the unresolved sources. It goes as the square root of the number of sources, so the square root of the surface brightness. But it still gives you this pretty peaked thing, not a flattened distribution like the M31 halo. You got a question?
There must be a bunch of other things you can do with the
mega data. Well, we have a list of about half a dozen studies of variable stars that we'd like to do. I mean, we have a large number of eclipsing variables, Cepheids, and Miras, along with just irregular red variables. And then there are a number of objects we just don't know what they are. And we figure that if you look at all the variable stars in a galaxy the size of M31, they're just going to be some strange things. But just as an example, the Miro light curves are tracing stars that are of masses of, say, 0.8 to 2 solar masses on the main sequence, whereas the Cepheids are tracing things more like 2 to 8 times the solar mass. And so you can, to some degree, look at the ratio of these two populations, which we're detecting at nearly 100%, and get an idea of what the stellar population is like, even in regions where HST can't resolve the individual stars on the main sequence to form a color magnitude diagram. We can basically subtract off 99% of the stars and study the variable star population and get some idea. That's one of the papers we're writing. Yeah, I think I better shut up, right?
I think I was going to say one more question. Paul was going
to ask if you can separate the events due to stars from the events due to the
galaxy. Other than by the spatial distribution and to some degree the time scale, no, but as far as individual events go, they're just Kozinski curves. And the width of the timescale distribution, I mean, we have a paper coming out in the APJ soon that shows all of these models. The width is very broad, so you can't set a discriminator in timescale to pull it out between stars and machos. Okay.
One more talk before the break.